So are heat and cold, red and white, an ox and an ass. Truth exists. There is a God. From a scientific perspective, these statements could not be more different, ranging as they do from mathematical truths, for example, the three angles of a triangle are equal to two right angles, definitional truths, a whole is greater than a part, every effect has a cause, and undisputed empirical facts, the sun will rise tomorrow, to claims that are disputable to varying degrees. I am the same being today that I was yesterday, or even 20 years ago. Truth exists. Articles of faith. There is a God. And normative opinions. Ingratitude ought to be blamed and punished. But from a common sense perspective, they are indistinguishable. To Beattie, it was no less self-evident that one's soul is distinct from one's body than it was that the sun would rise tomorrow. He was equally certain of each, and critically, certain that any other sensible person would be certain about them also. Indeed, it is precisely the consensus of sensible people that conveys commonness, and hence legitimacy. But who then are these sensible others? Definitions of common sense are frustratingly vague on this point also. Typically, the speaker asserts the existence of a body of like-minded individuals, who are, presumably, equally possessed of common sense. But then, all reasonable people is indistinguishable from all people who agree with me. As I mentioned earlier, this definitional vagueness is a useful rhetorical weapon, because anyone who does not agree with me can be written off as unreasonable, obviating the need for me to justify my beliefs any further. But it also makes common sense a very bad way to resolve political disputes, because when two people disagree, their only recourse is to brand each other as unreasonable. It's therefore no surprise that arguments that invoke common sense quickly degenerate into ad hominem attacks and name-calling. In matters of common sense, every disagreement is personal as well as substantive. For the same reason, what is common sense to one group of people in one time and place is not necessarily common to other groups. For example, while the impossibility of talking animals or inanimate objects coming to life may be self-evident to most adults, it isn't necessarily so to children, who may well believe such things. Going further, babies have such a poor understanding of common sense notions like gravity, heat, and water that they must be prevented from burning themselves, drowning, or falling out of their cribs. What is common sense to adults is not common to babies and children, who must be taught. Typically, this learning process happens naturally, because children generally trust their parents, teachers, and other adult role models sufficiently to simply accept that what they are being told is true. But that doesn't mean it is unproblematic. Because most of us learn common sense from the adults around us when we are children, what we learn is generally specific to our region, culture, class, and era. By the time we start interacting with people who are very different from us, we have already absorbed a lot of self-evident truths, many of which are not actually self-evident, or even necessarily true. Yet because the way we learn truths like dropped objects will fall to the ground, or hot things will burn you, is the same as how we learn truths like God exists, and ingratitude ought to be blamed and punished, that is, by being told them repeatedly by people we trust. Just like Beattie, we can't tell the difference. The result is that disagreements over common sense are not only bitterly personal. In any large, diverse society, they are inevitable. Within any society, that is, members of different cultural backgrounds, races, geographical regions, socioeconomic statuses, education levels, and time periods will inevitably develop their own distinct collections of beliefs about the world. Taken literally, in other words, common sense, meaning a single body of knowledge that is shared by all sensible people, does not exist. Rather, there exists a multitude of common senses, possibly as many as there are people. Yet because these beliefs are internalized as self-evident truths, rather than as subjective opinions, each person believes his or her own, possibly unique, version of common sense to be the universally correct one, shared by all sensible others. The sarcastic remark that there is nothing common about common sense is therefore right, but for the wrong reasons. Whereas the remark is usually intended as a lament on the stupidity of others, the reality is that there is no single body of knowledge that is self-evident to everyone. Not everything that is true is self-evident. The highly subjective and group-specific nature of common sense already makes it ill-suited for governing any group of people diverse enough to disagree about what counts as self-evident. But common sense has an even bigger problem when applied to government, which is that much of what is true is not self-evident to anyone. Science, for example, is filled with statements that are true, in that they are supported by the preponderance of theory and evidence, but are not self-evident no matter how much personal experience one acquires. One way to think about science, in fact, is as a method for discovering truths about the world that can't be gleaned from ordinary, everyday experience. In certain domains of science, such as in physics, we are reasonably comfortable accepting the existence of truths that are non-obvious, or even mind-bending. For example, when a team of astronomers announces that they have detected a new planet orbiting a distant star, we have no way of seeing the planet ourselves, nor do we have detailed knowledge of the complicated theories and methods that the astronomers are using to infer its existence. Nevertheless, we accept that the astronomers, building on the work of hundreds of years of science, have established what they and their colleagues consider to be compelling evidence. Thus, we accept the existence of extrasolar planets as a truth about the universe, even though nothing about it is self-evident. In contrast, our treatment of social science is often less than deferential. Whether it is economists explaining how a nation's debt is different from a family's debt, or biostatisticians explaining how mammograms might actually cause more harm than good, or sociologists claiming that Harry Potter might just have been a fluke of history. When the conclusions of social scientists do not jibe with common sense, our reaction is not surprise and delight, like when astronomers claim to have detected Earth-like planets orbiting a distant star, or physicists claim to have slowed light to walking pace, but rather skepticism and even anger. The difference, I would argue, is essentially one of familiarity. Because so much of physics deals with topics like subatomic particles and gravity waves that are very distant from everyday experience, it feels more like a compliment to common sense than a challenge to it. In social science, however, almost everything overlaps to some extent with everyday experience. We are all members of social networks. We all engage in economic transactions. We all seek to persuade and influence others. And we all participate in politics. Unlike explanations about distant planets or subatomic particles, therefore, the explanations of social science bear on phenomena about which common sense also has a lot to say. This is not to say that social science can't discover truths about the world that are not self-evident from our own experience. In a world of billions of people interacting with one another in countless ways to produce all manner of phenomena, from business cycles and financial crises to social norms and political revolutions to cultural fads and fashions, there are plenty of mysteries for science to explore. Yet because common sense has already staked out so much of this terrain for itself, social science seems less like a useful complement and more like an unwelcome interloper. Rather than explaining mysteries that we had never even thought about, let alone expected to understand, it seeks to explain familiar outcomes and objects that we thought we already understood. If the intuition we gain from personal experiences were a reliable guide for social and economic theory, then there would be no problem, and social science would be much easier. But it is not, for at least three reasons. First, intuition is a surprisingly poor predictor of individual behavior, especially when that behavior concerns people who are not like us or whose circumstances differ from ours. Second, individual actions aggregate in counterintuitive ways through networks of dependencies. And third, we learn less from history than we think we do. Three limitations of common sense reasoning. The first problem with common sense as a means of reasoning about human behavior is that it is intrinsically rational. I don't mean rational in the sense of Homo economicus, the toy model of human behavior advanced by neoclassical economics and easily debunked by everyday observation. McFadden, 1999. But rather, the older and more general notion of rationality that comes from sociology. Weber, 1968. In which human decision-making resides in our conscious minds. People anticipate the future, form preferences over the possible outcomes they might experience, and make plans to attain the outcomes they prefer. It follows from this framework that the choices people make necessarily reflect their preferences. Mayhew, 1980. This notion of rationality is extremely plausible, common sense even, and is highlighted in Freakonomics-style books that extol the power of incentives to guide and explain behavior. But as several decades of psychology and behavioral economics research has demonstrated, Ariely, 2008, Gilovich, Griffin, and Kahneman, 2002. It ignores what Daniel Kahneman calls System 2 thinking, Kahneman, 2011, which resides in our unconscious brains and can be influenced by, among other things, subtle details in the presentation of options, Thaler and Sunstein, 2008. For example, default settings, Johnson and Goldstein, 2003. Cognitive loads imposed by background environmental stresses, Mullinathan and Shafir, 2013, and implicit biases arising from cultural stereotypes and irrelevant personal experience, Banaji and Greenwald, 2016. Complicating matters further is Marx's famous observation, men make their own history, but they do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances transmitted from the past. To cite a simple but profound example, 80% of the global variation in lifetime wealth can be accounted for by which country one is born in. Milanovic, 2010. And most of the rest is accounted for by the wealth and education of one's parents, both circumstances that are clearly outside anyone's choosing. The broad lesson is that choices are often governed by factors to which common sense is largely oblivious. From this perspective, it is no surprise that advocates of common sense react to nudging and related approaches with some combination of contempt and alarm. It simply isn't common sense that the placement of items in the cafeteria, or the format of an application form, or the default option for 401k deductions should make any difference to consequential decisions. It follows that interventions of this sort must either be useless or else some Machiavellian plot by social scientists to manipulate the masses. Either way, they should be rejected out of hand. Likewise, evidence that circumstances can powerfully shape life course trajectories is dismissed out of hand on the grounds that a single counterexample can be found. Indeed, the current Secretary of Housing and Human Development, Ben Carson, has recently argued that poverty is a state of mind, using as evidence his own experience growing up in Detroit and becoming a successful brain surgeon. Alcindor, 2017. Although Carson's reaction was deservedly panned as naive, it is not that different from widely accepted meritocratic explanations of success and failure that place the bulk of responsibility on the choices of the individual, systematically discounting the pervasive influence of circumstances on outcomes. Frank, 2016. The second problem is that individual choices are often subject to social influence, or what economists call peer effects, meaning that the choice that is most desirable or simply the most available to one person depends on what others are doing. Individuals are bound together by complex networks, which can propagate beliefs and behavior in ways that are fundamentally at odds with common sense. In a seminal paper, Mark Granovetter, 1978, showed how surprising the dynamics of networked systems can be. Granovetter imagined a hypothetical crowd of agitators on the brink of violence, where each member has some threshold for acting out that depends on how many others are. If one member has a threshold of zero, he will trigger without provocation. If a second actor has a threshold of one, the first actor will set him off. If another actor has a threshold of two, he will then trigger, and so on. The point is that in an environment where everyone is responding to what everyone else does, a single action can trigger a series of knock-on effects that unravel into total chaos. But Granovetter's analysis also showed that this unraveling is highly susceptible to small deviations in the underlying distributions of thresholds. For example, if there is no one with a threshold of one, and two actors with a threshold of two, a tiny, probably undetectable difference in underlying preferences, the violence will stop with just the first actor. No unraveling will occur. To an observer, the two scenarios could not look more different. The single agitator jostling an otherwise orderly crowd versus a full-scale riot. Yet ex ante, there is essentially no difference. Watts, 2011. Effects like these show up everywhere. For example, markets can exhibit network effects. Economides, 1996. Meaning that small differences in market share can be amplified over time for reasons unrelated to intrinsic quality, possibly creating lock-in, Arthur, 1989, whereupon dominant players can be nearly impossible to displace. For example, Microsoft and PCs, Google and search, Facebook and social media. In a similar way, individuals can benefit from cumulative advantage, Dupreet and Eirich, 2006. Rigney, 2010. Such that initially similar people can experience wildly different careers because of small early fluctuations. Collective social and economic behavior can also display both surprising sensitivity and robustness. Over the course of little more than a decade, same-sex marriage transformed from a socially aberrant practice among an excluded minority to a fundamental civil right, while over the same period, attitudes about religion, immigration, and taxation hardly budged. Finally, social systems can suffer from collective action problems. Olson, 1965, Schelling, 1973, in which the outcome that everyone would prefer, for example, clean air, pristine wilderness, reliable infrastructure, safe neighborhoods, fails because no one individual has the ability or incentive to provide it. A situation that is sometimes called a tragedy of the commons. Hardin, 1968. Following Granovetter's logic, the gravest danger of Trump's recent decision to exit the Paris Climate Accord is not the direct impact that U.S. non-compliance would have on global temperatures, although that could indeed be grave, but rather the second, third, and higher order effects of the move. Just like in Granovetter's model, if other countries hold firm, the impact of the U.S. withdrawal may be minimal. But if even a few other countries use the U.S. withdrawal as an excuse to withdraw themselves, then Trump's action could trigger a cascade of defections leading to the complete unraveling of the pact. Likewise, the stability of the health insurance marketplaces under the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as ACA or Obamacare, depends on essentially the same dynamics. If, say, Congress takes away subsidies and the individual mandate, the cost of health insurance will rise, leading healthier people to drop their insurance. The costs of covering the remaining sicker people will then also rise, causing some companies to raise prices or to drop out of the market, thereby reducing competition and raising prices even further. Costs then go up further, leading other consumers to drop coverage, and so on. Death spirals can result, destroying the whole market. A common-sense leader like Trump is untroubled by such imponderables. He just makes a strong, simple, and clear decision and lets the chips fall where they may. But that's the point. Common sense is not wired to think about second and higher order effects of policy interventions. Fissman and Golden, 2017. And as a result, decisions based only on the first order effects continually elicit unintended consequences. Merton, 1936. Scott, 1998. Of course, by the time these consequences have arrived, lots of other things have happened, so there is plenty of scope for disavowing responsibility. If the climate accord unravels, Trump can claim it was a bad deal that was doomed to fail and the U.S. was right to get out first. If the health insurance markets crater, he can say Obamacare was a disaster and their collapse just proves it. Ultimately, there's no way to prove him wrong. We can't go back in time and rerun history with a different decision to see if it would have worked out better. If no one understands the dynamics at play, because, after all, none of this is common sense. It's just one person's story about what happened versus another's. This leads us to the third problem with common sense, which is that it systematically mishandles counterfactuals. What might have happened had things played out differently? Counterfactuals are central to scientific explanations, because explanations are fundamentally answers to causal questions. Did X cause Y to happen? And the only way to show that X caused Y is to observe both the factual outcome, X happened, and also the counterfactual, X did not happen, and check the effect on Y. Only if Y is significantly more likely to happen in the presence of X than in its absence, can we say that X caused Y. It is not an exaggeration to say that without considering counterfactuals, or as they are sometimes called, potential outcomes, statements about causality, and hence scientifically valid explanations, are impossible. Morgan and Winship, 2014. It is for this reason that experiments are so important to the scientific method, because in an experiment, you can systematically vary X, the treatment, and then directly observe the causal effect on Y. In much of social science, however, true experiments are impossible. The U.S. can't invade half of Iraq and not the other half to see which approach works out better. The Federal Reserve can't set the interest rate at one level for a year and then rerun history with a different rate to measure the causal effect on inflation. And companies can't hire two CEOs who get to run different instances of the same company to see who is more successful. As a result, social scientists and statisticians have devoted a huge amount of effort to devising clever ways to identify causal effects in non-experimental data. Dunning, 2012. Imbens and Rubin, 2015. Morgan and Winship, 2014. Common sense, however, has no problem coming up with answers to causal questions without doing experiments or using any fancy statistics. We just focus on some particular why, say, Donald Trump's surprise victory in the 2016 presidential election, and some particular X, say, James Comey's decision to reopen his investigation of Hillary Clinton's email usage, and imagine how Y might have been different had X been different. This process comes so naturally to us that you are probably now shaking your head and asking, what's wrong with that? What's wrong is that the resulting explanations are not, in fact, explanations at all in the causal sense, but rather are causal stories, plausible-sounding narratives that are dressed up to look like explanations. Mitchell, 2004. Just like ordinary stories, causal stories are generally invoked to make sense of individual outcomes that we find interesting. The outcome of an election, the financial crisis. And just like stories, they can be told only after we know the outcome in question. Finally, like ordinary stories, the main point of causal stories is to make us feel better, by allowing us to feel that we have made sense of something, or simply by entertaining us. Unfortunately, because causal stories have the form of real explanations, they also mislead us into thinking that we have understood the mechanisms behind what we have observed, when in fact, all we have done is describe it. Watts, 2014. In summary, The combination of neglecting unconscious biases, background circumstances, and network dynamics makes common sense surprisingly bad at understanding, and more important, predicting, human behavior, especially at scale and over time. Once the outcome is known, however, the ease with which we can imagine contrafactuals allows us to construct plausible causal stories out of mere associations. In this way, common sense constantly covers up its own mistakes, effortlessly inventing explanations that seem obvious regardless of the outcome. If we wish to actually understand how the world of human affairs works, therefore, we need to move beyond common sense and adopt the same kind of scientific approach that has worked in other areas of science. A scientific approach to decision-making. Of course, one might point out that many experts who have sold themselves as advocates of science also have a lousy track record of predicting political outcomes. Tetlock, 2005. Designing Economic Development Plans. Easterly, 2006. Scott, 1998. Running Hedge Funds. Lowenstein, 2000. And Averting Financial Crises. Bookstabber, 2017. Reinhardt and Rogoff, 2009. Even if common sense is a flawed basis for managing human affairs, what grounds do we have for believing that science can do any better? It is a reasonable question, but there is a big difference between decisions made by experts and decisions made in a scientific manner. That is, while experts often characterize their decision-making process using the language of science, the reality is that a great deal of what is presented as expert judgment is very often still just one person's opinion about what should work. Scott, 1998. That the person in question happens to have a PhD or some other qualification does not immunize him or her against cognitive biases. It may even exacerbate them. Kammerer and Johnson, 1997. Nor does it improve the accuracy of the person's predictions. Tetlock, 2005. The all-too-frequent failures of experts should therefore be interpreted not as arguments in favor of abandoning expertise in favor of common sense, but rather as an argument to emphasize systematic evidence and rigorous evaluation over individual intuition and anecdotal experience, regardless of whose intuition and experience is being relied upon. Watts, 2011. In other words, adopting a scientific approach to decision-making in government is not as simple as stacking your bench with experts. Rather, it is about finding people who can recognize the complexity of the problems they are facing, and who are therefore suspicious of their own instincts about how a complex system will respond to some intervention. Rather than leaping to the obvious conclusion in a moment of gut consultation, a scientific thinker considers a range of competing explanations, demands evidence for all of them, and strives to avoid logical fallacies when evaluating the evidence. If the evidence is inconclusive, the scientific thinker demands that additional evidence be collected before proceeding. For example, by conducting experiments, or looks for ways to hedge risk by pursuing multiple strategies simultaneously. Rather than seeking to solve every problem de novo, a scientific thinker looks for existing solutions that have already been shown to work, possibly in other contexts, and seeks either to spread the relevant knowledge or adapt it to the context in question. Finally, when a risky decision must be made about a situation that has never existed before and about which no more evidence can be collected, the kind of big call that heads of state and corporations sometimes have to make, a scientific thinker exhibits epistemic modesty. That is, he or she doesn't conflate the necessity of a decision, which may be high, with his or her own certainty in making it. In other words, scientific decision-making in government looks for evidence-based solutions when they exist, and minimizes the possibility of catastrophic errors even when they do not. Of course, this is easier said than done. Many of the outcomes that we care about, the future of the Paris Accords, the future state of healthcare in the U.S., are so complex and involve so many interconnected decisions that they are, for all intents and purposes, impossible to predict, even with all the data and scientific knowledge in the world. Maybe one day we'll be able to do a better job of predicting them. But for the foreseeable future, even the most prudent decision-maker will occasionally blunder. For example, of all recent administrations, Obama's placed a lot of weight on expert opinion. But that didn't stop them from staging a disastrous intervention in Libya, where toppling a ruthless dictator led to an even worse situation than existed before. And then, having presumably absorbed that lesson, they declined to intervene aggressively in Syria, only to watch helplessly as that ruthless dictator proceeded to unleash the world's worst humanitarian crisis since World War II, a crisis that is now fueling terrorist actions far beyond the region. Even in the matter of his signature domestic achievement, the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare, Obama failed to anticipate the relentless hostility with which it would be greeted by conservatives, and which, at the time of writing, continues to threaten its survival. Obama himself seems to have recognized the difficulty of his approach to problem-solving, conceding in an interview, Lewis 2012, "Nothing comes to my desk that is perfectly solvable. Otherwise, someone else would have solved it. So you wind up dealing with probabilities. Any given decision you make, you'll wind up with a 30-40% chance that it isn't going to work. You have to own that and feel comfortable with the way you made the decision. You can't be paralyzed by the fact that it might not work out. On top of all this, after you made your decision, you need to feign total certainty about it. People being led do not want to think probabilistically." Unfortunately, while Obama may have diagnosed his situation correctly, he was unable to persuade the American people that his solution was the right one. Common sense relies on narratives, and good narratives require conflict, drama, and most of all, an endpoint at which the story can be wrapped up, a victor can be declared, and a message can be told. A probabilistic approach like Obama's, by contrast, seeks to improve performance on average and over many decisions. It doesn't yield a good outcome every time, and emphasizes evidence and correctness over drama and resolution. Much like science, it is slow, complicated, and very often lacks any clear resolution. Unlike issuing commands, making stirring speeches, or dropping bombs on your enemies, probabilistic thinking comes across as bloodless, even spineless. If your efforts fail even once, you're a disaster. And even if you succeed, the fruits of your labor will likely not be realized until long after you're out of office. As dramatic as the shift from Obama to Trump has been, the direction is perhaps not surprising. From a PR standpoint, probabilistic thinking and epistemic modesty are no match for common sense. The problem of legitimacy. To summarize the argument so far, leaders wishing to avoid the lure of common sense face three serious challenges. First, centuries of paeans to common sense have persuaded a large part of the electorate that common sense is all that is required to solve the problems of government, that failures of government are not failures of common sense, but rather failures to use common sense. Second, although common sense is fundamentally unsuited to reasoning about the sort of large-scale social and economic phenomena that are the province of modern government, the nature of common sense makes its own shortcomings extremely difficult to perceive. Third, a scientific approach, which in theory at least has a better chance of generating good results, is extremely hard to sell, in part because social science is generally viewed as precisely the kind of fancily worded but ultimately muddle-headed thinking that common sense so proudly disdains. In other words, making the case for a scientific, as opposed to a common sense approach to government, depends critically on the perceived legitimacy of science as a way of understanding, and ultimately intervening in, human affairs. If science has no better claim on the truth than common sense, or any other way of generating explanations about the world, then rhetorical appeals to the instinctive perceptions, unschooled logic, and simple style of plain, sensible men will remain politically preferable to scientifically informed, evidence-based approaches to policy. Ultimately, therefore, the viability of a scientific approach to government turns on the question of trust in science more generally. In the end, an astronomer cannot prove to a non-specialist that invisible planets are orbiting some distant star any more than a parent can prove to her child that fairies don't exist. At some point, the listener must simply trust that astronomers have spent centuries honing their theories and methods, and that if they have reached a consensus about some fact, then they should be believed. The key point is that as different as scientific knowledge is from common sense in theory, in practice, it attains its legitimacy in much the same way that common sense does, namely by trusting the consensus wisdom of some community. Scientific knowledge trumps common sense knowledge, only to the extent that scientific communities are trusted more than other communities. Without that trust, arguments between science and common sense are not really any different than arguments between different versions of common sense. Scientists become just another constituency with a point of view, to be believed or derided, depending on whether it coincides with one's own. If social scientists and other experts want their claims to be viewed as more legitimate than other claims on the truth, they must first persuade the public that their methods for reaching consensus are worthy of their trust. To this end, scientists need to do a better job of explaining to the public how the scientific process works. As any working scientist can tell you, science is a painstaking and often adversarial process of persuading one's peers that your ideas, methods, and evidence are worth taking seriously. It is not unusual for a single contribution to take years to research, write, and publish, and even then it is likely to be ignored, contradicted, or otherwise overwritten by someone else's. Building a broad consensus around a topic is therefore extremely challenging and typically takes decades when it happens at all. After so much collective effort to establish something that can pass as scientific fact, it is not surprising that scientists assume that it will be treated with deference. Yet, as climate scientists have discovered, even the broadest and most carefully established consensus, say, around the claim that global warming is both real and caused by human activity, can be dismissed with surprising ease on the grounds that the whole thing is a fiction cooked up by the research community to increase its own funding. As anyone who has endured the indignity of peer review or applied for research grants or otherwise struggled to have their ideas taken seriously can attest, the idea that thousands of scientists could collude on anything at all is ridiculously implausible. That the public can so easily be persuaded of the manipulability of entire scientific communities suggests that they have little appreciation of how science works. Part of the problem may be that the way science is portrayed in the media, with its focus on bold claims, exciting breakthroughs, and sudden flashes of genius, is quite unlike the frustratingly slow and incremental reality. Contrary to every movie involving mathematicians, very little useful science is conducted while scribbling equations furiously on a blackboard or a window. But even when scientists themselves try to reach the public directly, the pressure to tell an easily digestible and engaging story invariably influences what they say and how they say it. Not every idea lends itself equally to a 17-minute TED Talk. Not every argument can or should be made using cute analogies, 7-point lists, or personal anecdotes. And the grander and more sweeping a claim is, the less likely it is to be true. In other words, both for the journalists who cover science and for scientists themselves, communicating with the public presents an unavoidable conflict between engaging one's audience and accurately conveying the careful, systematic nature of science. If that element is left out of public portrayals on the grounds that it's boring and no one wants to hear about it, then it is not just that some poetic license has been taken for the sake of telling a good story. The whole essence of what makes science different from other ways of knowing, including common sense, has been omitted. One possible solution is for scientists to work with journalists and the media to more accurately characterize the painstaking and deliberative nature of science. Another is for scientists themselves to pay more attention to the Science of Science Communication, National Academies of Sciences and Medicine, 2017. An emerging field in which research on persuasion and decision-making is being applied to questions about scientific messaging specifically. For example, research in science communication consistently finds that trust in science does not correlate strongly with knowledge. To the contrary, learning more about some topic, for example, climate change, vaccines, GMOs, etc., can even increase skepticism about scientific claims. Simus and others, 2016. Simply presenting the facts, therefore, is not an effective means of communicating scientific findings, a result that flies in the face of traditional science training. Instead, scientists may have to rethink their relationship with the public. Rather than treating the public as a passive audience, either to be informed or entertained, scientists may need to treat the public more as a partner, with an active interest in both the process of science and also its consequences. In this way, scientists may more persuasively convey the facts about which they are certain, as well as better understand the concerns that their work may raise. Finally, if scientists want science to have the kind of legitimacy in the public eye that they believe it deserves, it is incumbent upon them to improve their own systems for aggregating reliable, replicable scientific knowledge. Collaboration, 2015. Munafo and others, 2017. To be clear, the problem is usually not that scientists have been negligent or malfeasant. Although fraud does occur in science, it appears to be relatively rare. So much as that the methods on which generations of social scientists have been trained turned out to be based on faulty assumptions. Gigerenzer, 2004. Ioannidis, 2005. Meal, 1990. Thus, even careful, well-intentioned scientists following what they believe to be the best practices of their field can end up producing work that is invalid. Gelman and Loken, 2014. Simmons, Nelson, and Simonson, 2011. And because the scientists reviewing their work for publication have all been trained the same way, peer review is ill-equipped to catch these errors. Indeed, by favoring work that makes bold, original contributions over boring replications, peer review may even increase the prevalence of erroneous research. Smaldino and McElrath, 2016. Given the difficulty that even professional scientists have when evaluating the validity of claims within their own areas of expertise, it is unreasonable to expect journalists and members of the public to do so either. Conclusion. It is common these days to lament the lack of respect for truth in political debate, and for good reason. It is hard to think of a precedent for Trump's near-constant stream of misleading statements, falsehoods, and outright lies, including about relatively objective, verifiable facts, like Barack Obama's birthplace, the size of his own inauguration crowds, the millions of illegal voters, and so on. Adding fuel to the fire, a shocking number of undeniably fake news stories circulated on social media during the election campaign, in some cases generating more reader eyeballs than competing real news. Whether any of this is worse than it has been in the past is difficult to establish, but it is certainly bad enough that a discussion of the place of truth in public debates, or at least a shared sense of reality, seems urgently needed. It has been my contention in this essay that deference to common sense is detrimental to this goal. As useful as common sense may be in navigating ordinary, everyday circumstances, the fundamental assumption of common sense, that truth should be self-evident, is wrong for two important reasons. First, because common sense draws no distinction between objective and subjective truths. What is self-evident to one person can be non-obvious, wrong, or even abhorrent to another. And second, much of what is true in a scientific sense is not self-evident in any meaningful sense to most people. If truth is to be the guiding principle of political debate, therefore, common sense must defer to science in matters of social and economic policy, as it has in matters of physics and chemistry. If that is to happen, however, then science, and social science in particular, must do a much better job than it has of building public trust. In part, that will require scientists to do a better job of persuading a skeptical public that their methods are better suited to establishing truth than other ways of knowing, including common sense. And in part, it will require scientists to improve their methods, which currently do not work as well as advertised. In closing, it is worth noting that science has dealt successfully with legitimacy problems before. In the late 18th and early 19th century, the scientific world was undergoing transformative changes, in no small part because new instruments and methods were allowing scientists to observe and quantify phenomena that had previously been ephemeral. As is the case today with big data transforming once sleepy areas of social science, public interest in the sciences was extremely high. Scientists like Humphrey Davy, a celebrated chemist, inventor of the Davy safety lamp, and fierce advocate of the scientific method, occupied almost celebrity status. But so was public skepticism. In effect, science was claiming for itself areas of human knowledge, like the size of the universe and the nature of the elements, that had for hundreds of years been the province of religion and poetry. The traditional arbiters of truth found their status increasingly challenged by a new breed of experts who brought with them methods and a level of self-assurance in their answers that the old guard naturally found deeply threatening. No less a figure than Isaac Newton was castigated by John Keats, himself a giant figure in the culture of the time, who claimed that Newton's historic discovery of the color spectrum of white light had destroyed all the poetry of the rainbow. Holmes, 2010. These days, it is hard to imagine a poet directly criticizing the work of the world's preeminent physicist. If anything, physicists have co-opted the language of poets to describe their work. But something similar is arguably happening in politics and business, where centuries of explanation based on intuition and narrative are being challenged by reams of data and statistical analyses. As with the Romantic era poets, traditional sources of authority resent the intrusion and seek to undermine the challengers with appeals to common sense. And yet, there is a glimmer of hope in this story. If the hard sciences also had to overcome public skepticism about their legitimacy, perhaps the social sciences can also. Law and the Slow Motion Emergency, David A. Strauss. If it happens here, it won't happen all at once. A large, diverse society with democratic traditions and a strong civil society is unlikely to become an autocracy overnight. The more plausible scenario is a gradual erosion of liberal democratic norms. Each step might be objectionable, but not by itself alarming. Even at the end of the line, a version of democratic institutions might remain. There will be elections, although they will have predictable outcomes. Civil servants and judges will sometimes be independent, although not on important matters. And occasionally, dissidents will be tolerated. The institutions will have been hollowed out. Much of what we value in a liberal democracy will be lost. But there will have been no single, cataclysmic point at which democratic institutions were demolished. For the same reason, the steps toward authoritarianism will not always, or even usually, be obviously illegal. Grossly illegal acts are unlikely to get very far. There are too many sources of resistance to them. Each individual step will stretch the law only a little. In fact, each step might conform to the letter of the law. But each step, legal in itself, might undermine liberal democracy a little bit more. This is a paradox, but it reflects an intrinsic feature of a liberal society. Well-functioning liberal institutions are inherently vulnerable to anti-liberal actors. Opponents of democracy can win free elections. Intolerant sects can take advantage of religious toleration. Individuals determined to eradicate free expression can invoke laws protecting free expression, and ultimately might get the power to demolish those protections. And the same thing can happen with government officials. They can exploit features of a liberal democracy to turn it in an illiberal direction. They can do this because the legal system of a functioning democracy is not set up to deal with a systematic effort to undermine democratic institutions. In particular, on an everyday basis, a legal system has to give officials some leeway to use their judgment. Courts obviously can't redo every decision that every official makes. Most of the time, courts have to uphold most decisions, provided they fall within a range of acceptability. They have to assume that officials usually act in good faith. Officials who set out to subvert liberal democratic norms, whether they do it by design or by instinct, will be able to take advantage of that assumption. Courts, following the law, which is designed for conscientious officials who are committed to liberal democracy, might give officials with authoritarian inclinations the benefit of the doubt, time after time, until liberal democratic institutions are fatally undermined. When that seems to be happening, how should courts respond? Actions that take advantage of weaknesses in the law are still, at least in one sense, lawful. But if judges follow the law and allow those actions, they may be contributing to the erosion of democracy. What is the alternative, though? Violating the law they are sworn to uphold? Sometimes that is the choice. Either break the law or contribute to the downfall of liberal democracy. But the dilemma need not be that stark. The better response is to treat a systematic effort to undermine liberal democratic norms as a kind of emergency, in the way that, say, a natural disaster or a terrorist attack is an emergency. There are two differences, though. An attack on liberal democratic norms is a slow-motion emergency, one that, as I've said, unfolds gradually, unlike the more familiar sudden emergency. And unlike the more familiar kind of emergency, which might require granting more power to government officials, a slow-motion slide toward authoritarianism requires the opposite, limiting the power of government officials. But fundamentally, the dilemma for a judge or someone in a similar position is the same in both kinds of emergencies. Following the law in the usual way might bring about a calamity. Departing from the law is a gravely troubling step. There is a school of thought that holds that emergencies call for extra legal action, and one can imagine extreme cases in which a threat to liberal democratic norms is so severe that courts and other officials should resist it by illegal action if need be. But apart from the most extreme cases, the right response to an emergency, sudden or slow motion, is not to disregard the law, but to shape it and adapt it. Rather than either acting in the way they would in normal circumstances, or treating the law as irrelevant, judges, or others in a similar position, should push the limits of the law in a way that addresses the emergency conditions, that resists the slide into illiberality or authoritarianism. In a deep way, that can be a lawful thing to do. The rule of law requires that courts apply established principles, but it also allows those principles to evolve in response to particular circumstances. In the past, some actions by courts that seemed to go too far in adapting principles to specific threats, that seemed to subvert the law in order to prevent a greater evil, turned out to be not just acceptable, but celebrated examples of how the law should work. The civil rights era of the mid-20th century gives us several examples. Actions that seemed legally questionable at the time, but that we later came to see as examples of how the law can adapt itself to circumstances that threaten the foundations of our liberal democratic order. The response to the threat of authoritarianism can take the same form. There are many questions buried here. Do we trust judges or anyone else to know when there is a slow-motion emergency? Isn't it common for people to think that policies they strongly oppose are the first step toward the collapse of the basic norms of democratic society? How far can judges go in adapting the law before their actions become simply unlawful? Can judges be trusted to find that limit? These questions are very hard to answer. But, as with sudden emergencies, there are risks in both directions, not just overreacting to the emergency, but failing to react. 1. Early in its tenure, the Trump administration issued, and later revised, an executive order that temporarily restricted immigration from certain predominantly Muslim countries. The litigation about that executive order shows how courts might respond to a slow-motion emergency. The basis for the executive orders was a federal statute that says the president may suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens if the president finds that their entering the country would be detrimental to the interests of the United States. The executive orders asserted that the restrictions were needed to protect against terrorists entering the United States. Ordinarily, courts would unhesitatingly uphold such an executive order. The phrasing of the statute suggests that the decision is the president's alone. The criterion that the president is to apply, whether entry into the country is detrimental to the interests of the United States, invites the exercise of discretion. And both national security and immigration are, traditionally, subjects on which the courts defer to the decisions of the executive branch. The courts did not react that way to the Trump order, though. An early version of the executive order was enjoined, and the injunction was upheld on appeal. The administration then withdrew that version of the order and issued a second version that was designed to address the problems the courts had found in the initial version. But the second version, too, met a hostile reception in several courts. Some courts said there was evidence that the executive orders were the result of animosity toward Muslims, and therefore violated constitutional protections of religious neutrality. Others said that the president had not adequately explained why the restriction was needed to prevent harm to the United States. The courts also had to overcome some technical barriers before they could block the executive order. Non-citizens living outside the United States are generally not protected by U.S. law. So the suits against the executive orders were brought by people and institutions inside the country who claimed they were harmed by the restrictions on immigration. There was a question whether their interests were the kind that could support a lawsuit. Strictly as a legal matter, were those courts' decisions correct or not? The answer to that question is more complicated than it seems. Often legal rules are entirely clear. There is a right answer to a legal question and no room for reasonable disagreement. But sometimes, and commonly in cases that wind up in litigation, there is a range of plausible answers. That is not to say they are all equally plausible. A judge who has to decide the case will identify the answer that, in her view, is better than the others. But even incorrect legal conclusions might be plausible. Many important legal institutions are built on the idea that there can be a range of plausible answers to a legal question, even if one answer is better than the others. Lawyers have an ethical obligation not to make arguments that lack any legal basis, and they can be punished if they violate that duty. But they also have an obligation to make plausible arguments on behalf of their clients, even if they think those arguments are, in the end, not convincing. Government officials, police officers, for example, can be sued for violating an individual's constitutional rights, but they will not have to pay money damages even for a constitutional violation if a reasonable constitutional argument could have been made in support of what they did. In some circumstances, a court will overturn another court's decision if that decision was outside the bounds of reasonableness, but not if the decision was merely incorrect. The decisions of the courts that rejected the Trump executive orders were not obviously correct, but they were within the bounds of plausibility. There is a well-established principle that the government may not deliberately favor some religions over others, and there was evidence